I do thank you all. I always approach assignments like this with nerves and trepidation. I don't think I'll ever be different till I die. I used to pray that it would be different. I'm 54 and I think God isn't even saying no. God is just not making me without nerves and trepidation, but after we start talking and we form a community, it becomes such a pleasure. I end up saying things I didn't even think about beforehand, or at all, maybe. So thanks for your kindness, giving lodgment to my words in your ears and your spirits, and for me too. If I began this fourth and final lecture on the Advent Gospel Lessons Series A by saying I have a round, unvarnished tale to tell, who here would be able to tell me what I'm quoting? Oh, Fanny? Fanny's been taking Shakespeare, and it really has increased the value of our conversation. All these years married, and now we're sitting and chawing over King Lear and Othello and stuff like that. Her taking these courses has been my pleasure. It truly has been. I wasn't kidding. I have a round, unvarnished tale to tell today. And Fan, what does round, unvarnished mean? Yeah. Unembellished, round means that there's nothing added. This is the thing, this is the story, this is the thing itself. Das Ding an sich, we say in German. This is it. This is where we come to. The fourth Sunday is finally the preparation for the celebration of the Nativity of Jesus. That's where we are at this point. And then you'll go through the whole process then. One Sunday starts, comes tomorrow. And what we've been thinking about and talking about during these last 2 days, you'll be able to experience and enact dramatically for the next 4 weeks. And more or less, I guess it's less. But this is the story. This is the preparation. And the story I'm going to use is Joseph's story. I'm going to stick pretty close to the text this time and just sort of unravel it and tell it as we go. I've indicated here what it does with time. Our first gathering, we talked about time at the end of time. We talked about the end of time and the divisions of the peoples. The second time we gathered, we talked about the intermediate time and the various ways in which we find ourselves spiritually in darkness or separate, and then the call, the word that calls us out of the wordless place and grants us the words of speaking and the words of salvation. This morning we talked about the immediate thing. What do we do now, tomorrow, the next day? What's immediately upon us? And finally, we end with this story of Joseph's, which I think can become the shape of our present lives, our lives now. They can shape how we live and what we are, the same way in which putting water into some kind of a plastic form and freezing it, the form shapes the water. It becomes the shape of the water. It defines the water in the deepest sense of that word, de finis. Are you hiding?
No, I'm saving seats though.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to make faces behind your back.
Don't worry, I'll turn. Or I'll make my own face.
Hey, don't point that at me.
Joseph is going to become our paradigm today. And whereas in other stories and other Christian witnesses, people begin by saying, I was a sinner, or they begin with sin. Today we must begin with one who is righteous. Dikaios is the Greek word. Upright, just, righteous are the ways in which it's translated. The story begins by saying Joseph was an upright man. Joseph was a just man. So this story doesn't begin, you know, in the outcast periods or places where people find themselves. This story begins among those who have had some enlightenment or who have striven, let's put it that way, who have striven for righteousness, goodness, godness, whose hearts are inclined that way. And then I'm going to grant the story, or at least I find four parts for the story, a beginning of a definition of righteousness as Joseph is, and you already have it here. If I were doing this truly dramatically, I would not tell you part two until we got done with part one. But in part two, we will discover directly in our text that this righteousness, good as it is not enough. that something else is required, and I'm saying Advent is required, or an intervention, ad intervention, a completely divine act is required. It requires God to enter into our lives and accomplish something. And that's what becomes the core of the story or the message. And then the curious and beautiful thing is that we don't circle from righteousness to righteousness. We spiral from righteousness to righteousness. We begin with that effort and sweet definition of righteousness we ourselves may work at, and Joseph may be a model. But with the intervention, the advention, the advent of this act of God in the world, in Jesus, all of a sudden our righteousness becomes something altogether different. And because its source ultimately is not in ourselves, though it dwells in ourselves and we enact it, because its source is in God through Jesus, then it is enough. And we made joy. We made joy at the end of this, and I hope we can get to that point at the end. Some of these thoughts, which has helped me here in preparation, I finished a devotional book. I had written a devotional book for Lent called Reliving the Passion, and now I've done one for Advent, which I'm calling Making Ready. When we get to December 19th and we begin with these passages, I write this. Joseph the carpenter. Joseph, a common man caught up in cosmic affairs. I want us to see that Joseph really is our entrance into this story. The common man. The shepherds might be our entrance as well, but at this point, let Joseph be for us. I've often thought that Than and I sort of balanced Joseph because we've adopted children, and I have some sense, or at least I have that experience that I can imagine might have been Joseph's experience. I used to look at our little adopted children at the table, and I'd sort of blur my eyes. I'd try to blur their vision a little bit so that what I might find is that other face behind them, which is not my face or Than's face. You know, we look in the faces of the children that are born to us, and immediately there's a profound, unspeakable familiarity. It's as if what you're looking at you dwell in. I don't know, I mean, certainly you understand. I don't need to tell you what I'm talking about. We have a grandchild now, and among all the babies in the world, we look into the face of that grandchild, and there's something so familiar, so intimate in that, and I think that's because it's the procession of the genes and other things as well. But you adopt children, and their faces are uniquely their own. They're not yours. So I would sit at table and I would look at these faces that I so dearly loved, and I try to blur, to try to find what parental faces might lurk behind, which certainly existed there. We did that with Talitha, and many of you know, when Talitha was entering her second year at Spelman, we went looking for them and we found them. So I don't have to blur my eyes anymore to know those who are behind Talitha. We do for Matthew because he doesn't have interest in doing that search. But I think, for example, therefore, of Joseph. Blurring his eyes as he's looking at Jesus and trying to find that other parent. What must that parent look like in that figure? So Joseph is our entrance into this story. Joseph struggles with the knowledge and the not knowing that we do. The blurring of our eyes with baby faces to try to find what holy things are on the other side. And making some effort and not always succeeding at that. Joseph for us. Matthew chapter 1, beginning at verse 18. So you can follow with me. I won't read it through totally. I think I'll piecemeal it. Maybe I won't. I don't know. But it's there. You should have it open in front of you. All right. After the genealogies, is that what we have? Yes. Matthew begins with the genealogy. Luke begins with the birth. Now, the birth of Jesus the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Christos, the Christ, took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been engaged to Joseph, but before they lived together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. Well, we begin with a problem. We're going to begin with the righteous man, but the righteous man is confronted with a problem. And this is not unique in this world, that people who have covenanted with one another, one of the covenant breaks covenant, and the other one must suffer the break. Here it seems to be adultery. I can't sing, and I wouldn't press Tom into it, but you might all remember the songs and the songs of all of the ages from the very beginning time down till now, which are like Frankie and Johnny, we're sweethearts. all those brokenhearted songs where someone loves somebody else and that somebody else done them wrong. And you might, you know, first in a sort of joking way, since this is an event so common among us, and then in a serious way, as you're able to move yourself into that actual experience, either by memory or by the power of your imagination, become genuinely brokenhearted at all that means when you have covenanted with another human being. And you have upheld that covenant in sweet trust and perfect giving, and found out that the other in some form or another broke covenant. Adultery is only one way of breaking covenant, but it gets to your guts, you know. I mean, that becomes sort of like the paradigm of most breakings of covenants. We can go on and on. I don't mean to go farther than that, but when governments... Should I drink?
Sure.
Satisfied. Kathleen tells me I pick it up and I don't drink out of it. See how much community we are now?
Drink!
Can't get out of the next
time. Some of us prefer when you just pick it up and not drink.
Is that right? Oh, Lord, okay. Satisfy you all. Well, let this be a paradigm for all broken covenants, and then let's come down to the personal quality of that. This is why whole nations can sometimes genuinely grieve, though they don't know they're grieving when their governments break covenant with them. And take that wherever you want to go. I mean, that's a thought that requires all kinds of attention. But it's grief we enter, you understand. It's grief we enter when the covenant is broken, because it's the beginning of death, or it's the quality of death itself. When parents break covenant with children, teachers break covenant with students, bosses break covenant with employees, all of that. But finally we get down to this everlasting picture, and that's two individual human beings who have covenanted their whole lives one to another, their bodies, their souls, their spirits, and one breaks covenant. Now imagine the depth of Joseph's grief, as it might be. It's in that circumstance a righteous man acts. This righteous man acts, and we get a definition of what righteousness is. He didn't catch that word of the Holy Spirit. Who would? All he knows is that she's been with another man, and she's pregnant, and it's obvious. And it might even have been better if she'd come to him in advance and said something, but it seems, according to the development of this story, she didn't even tell him. He hugged her once and felt alone. Her husband Joseph, being a righteous man, and now we're going to get a definition of what this dikaios means, this righteousness means, and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, planned to dismiss her quietly. This is the NRSV. Some of you, I used in my translation the word divorce, planned to divorce her quietly. Some of you have put her away, I suppose. There are a variety of words, but I want to get at that specific word in a moment. What's the righteousness here? Well, the first thing is that Joseph does not do what so very, very many people do, and that is to demand his rights. Then, as now, many of us equate righteousness with rights. Evidently, our rights is not what defines righteousness. If Joseph defined his rights, as many of us do, we would go to court. We wouldn't put her away quietly. We would say something like this: she owes me. She's going to pay. And how she's going to pay is she's going to lose her reputation, she's going to go to court, I'm going to take her money, I'm going to do all numbers of things. I have the right. It's in the law. She hurts me, now she owes me. It's a whole concept somehow or other that when I have been wounded, now for things to be put at rights, now justice means that I should be compensated for my wound. That may work in the world's courts, but that's not what righteousness before God is. Righteousness is not a dwelling upon the self. It centers not on the self. And Joseph becomes our example. He shall not dwell upon himself. He doesn't do any number of things that people today or in the past feel they have a right to do. This is what righteousness is. She hurts me, I'm going to hit her. She hurt me, she hit me, in the solar plexus, I'm going to hit her. That's just, that's righteousness. What we call it is the lex talionis. That's the fancy Old Testament word. It's called an eye for an eye. Evidently, that's not righteousness here. She hurt me, I'm going to take her to court. I'm going to read you in just a moment some of the choices that Joseph had before him, and we will all feel horrible hearing what those choices are, but I am here to say that I think that they're not much different from things that human beings do to one another today when they feel that they are just because they have been hurt. Joseph doesn't do that. The other thing that Joseph doesn't do, and this is very important, especially for those of us who are of a romantic bent, I put myself there. Righteousness doesn't focus upon Mary either, or the other. In other words, Joseph divorces her quietly, intends to divorce her quietly, but Joseph does intend to divorce her. Now, my guess is, given my particular spirit, my romantic and artistic nature, that I would say, damn the world, damn the church, damn the laws of God, honey, it's you and me, or something like that, I don't know. In other words, sometimes we go the exact opposite of considering what righteousness is and think that what righteousness is a total focus on the other, and then we sacrifice ourselves. You've met those people, and sometimes we think they're gluttons for punishment, where they think, okay, they're going to strive hard to make it right with this person who sinned against them. Let's reverse the genders just for a moment without saying that one or the other is any more liable to sin or to. But how often doesn't the abused party say, okay, it's my fault, let me just change circumstances here and I won't be abused again. You follow what I'm saying? And so often we silently believe that this is what righteousness is. Bowing our head and taking it, or romantically just not becoming oblivious to any other requirement or established or standard, if you will, or Torah, sweet and beautiful mind of God law, and saying, well, we'll make it work. That's not righteousness either. So it's not on the one hand this brutal sort of thing, give me my own, nor is it on the other hand this romantic or what shall I say, it's not humility even. Not in, well, it's humiliation. Mortification kind of way, I'll give you whatever you want so we can make it right between us. These things are not righteousness, according to this. This righteous man focuses not on self and not on the other, but on God, and obeys. Well, in this case, we're going to see that what he focuses on is the law that's offered unto him, and in that law, he has choices. When I say he focuses on God, you must hang with me and jump down to this word merciful, because there is the choice of mercy there. That's number one. Righteousness focuses outside of ourselves, on something larger than ourselves. Not on me, not on the other who has broken it. But number two, righteousness is tempered with mercy as God is merciful. In other words, and by the way, I must always say, as I lay this in front of you, this is finally not going to be that rich. I say we will live according to. I want us to get down here, but first at least let's draw this picture of human beings trying to be their best. And so Joseph also tempers the thing with mercy. I want to show you some of the choices that were in front of Joseph. Deuteronomy 22 verses 20 to 21. This one is hard. For some odd reason, because of the details and the way in which it comes, it doesn't horrify us quite as much as the next one does. But this is the law that was in extant. This is the choice that in this particular instance a man could have. That's part of the sorrow and the grief of looking back to these things. I really mean that. That we look back at a time when the laws which made certain men righteous were also available unto men but not unto women. And you know, therefore, that's not righteousness. Here is what it reads in Deuteronomy. First it talks about if there is a charge against the woman and it's not true, then she remains as a wife. But then verse 20, if however the charge is true, that evidence of the young woman's virginity was not found, then they shall bring the young woman out to the entrance of her father's house, and the men of her town shall stone her to death, because she committed a disgraceful act in Israel by prostituting herself in her father's house. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. This isn't the only stoning. I mean, there are all kinds of stonings in the Old Testament. The fact that I select it out right now should not make that focused and alone. All I want to tell you is, stoning was available to Joseph. It was not much practiced in those days, but stoning was practiced in those days. We have evidence. Stephen was stoned. And it was under the same code of law that Stephen was stoned as Mary might have been. So he doesn't choose this. He has discretion. He doesn't choose to stone her. Now, this is just a discursive pause. The one thing, dear people, just generally, we ought not to do when we go to the Old Testament and find such horrible laws. One thing we ought not to do is say, idiots, fools, look what they did. We're not like that anymore. Boy, is it good we don't have a God like that. We do that a lot. The easiest thing is just to dismiss that whole baggage. Please let me say the thing that we ought to do is a self-assessment, our society, ourselves, our cultures, and ask whether the same things don't happen now under other guises. That's what we should do. Because if we find our particular practices also to have been existent in the Old Testament, then we will move dramatically, experientially, from the old to the relief and the release that begins to occur in the new covenant between God. And we will rejoice in the new covenant that we offer to other people. If we don't see that the ancestors of the Old Testament codify things that we do uncodify, but we do, then we'll be stuck in the Old Testament. The New Testament will have no genuine cleansing effect for us. You follow me? I'm asking you to always to take the harder road. And I don't have a lot of time, as you know, but you, I think all of you can think right now how we stone reputations, how we kill people in the workplace when we think that we are just in doing it. This law is available to us. How if we have a lot of money and power, we're the ones who win in court. And if we don't win in court, we'll win in the court of public opinion. How we can send people forth, male and female, send them forth with a great red A or whatever it is, something that destroys their reputation and their capacities ever thereafter. How we can take a whistleblower who actually acted in affection and goodness, not all of them do, but some of them do, and ruin their lives for the rest of it. You see, there it was at least codified. Here, where it doesn't happen under code, we can't even understand how to take that monster by the tail. Are you with me? Yes? Thank you. I don't want you to stone me for bringing up stoning laws. The next one is worse, and you can look at it for yourself. I don't have the time to read it. It's a long one. But Numbers takes that same concept and says, well, what if there are no witnesses for the woman? What if the husband is just jealous? And that's really the base of this law. What if the husband is jealous and suspects that she's fooled around with somebody else? What do you do then? Well, you make a potion with water. Into that water, the priest puts some of the dirt of the ground where the husband accuses her of having committed her adultery. Moreover, you write a curse upon her. You write that curse on a piece of paper, the priest does. And once the curse has been written and read aloud and read to her, where she sits in public with her hair disheveled in shame, all this without the proof, this is how we're going to find out whether it's true or false. Then you wash the curse off of that paper. It wasn't paper, it's vellum. And you wash the ink into this potion. Into that potion you put a bitterness as well, something which may have the effect of hurting her if she is a liar, and something that won't hurt her if she's telling the truth, because of course she's saying she didn't do it. This is Joseph's too. That's what I'm telling you. This is before him too. There probably were no witnesses for whatever it was the Holy Spirit did. So he could have this happen. And what would happen then is that the woman would drink this potion. The curse was, if you are lying, and if you are at fault, then your womb shall collapse, and your weight shall fall down. It's a Hebrew way of saying something that's very difficult to understand. They used to say dropsy, but it probably means that you may swell up as if you had a child, and then you will not have a child, and you will never have children again. Either because of a very bad pregnancy that ended horribly, or because it was a false pregnancy or whatever, but it would be an eternal thing. You would never bear children again, and then your husband could get rid of you. But if you are not lying, you'll swell up and have a baby, and you'll continue to be. He doesn't choose to do even that stuff which happens among us today, which, if the person proves innocent, still is hung around the neck of that person forever. Let me make it public. This man is a molester. Well, maybe. Well, maybe not. And finally, ultimately, it's proved he isn't. But you understand what I'm saying? Ever thereafter. Now, Joseph chooses the merciful course, which allows Mary no public noise at all. This is what's available to him from Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1. You may write a writ of divorce with two witnesses given to her, and the matter is done. It's still done, but it's done. Why is that mercy? There's a verse in Matthew 19 where people ask Jesus about this business of marriage and divorce. And this is what Jesus says about that verse, this Torah verse, Deuteronomy 24, that all you need is a writ, give it to the woman, and with two witnesses it'll be done. Jesus said, "For your hardness of heart, Moses, God, gave you this law." Now I have to give you some context to this. For your hardness of heart, why was that? Because men were just dumping women. And it was such a frightful thing. It had become such a frightful thing, both in the past and thereafter, that they were just dumping them, that when women got married, they knew the only thing they could take away from that marriage is what they wore into the marriage. Therefore, you would see a woman walking into her marriage and her clothes would be ringing. Tinkle, tinkle, ring, ring. Because she had sewn on the inside whatever coins she had gathered together, on the chance that he wouldn't like something she had done and simply got rid of her, and she could take her dress with her, in which would be the coins. Horrible circumstances. But this writ of divorce was an act of mercy in those circumstances, because with the writ of divorce, what it said was, this woman is free. She is free now to marry another. She can continue her life. The hardness of heart is that they would just dump women, and these women would be seen to be married, or married and abandoned, and therefore no one would have anything to do with them at all. I understand that the way in which I've come to this, it's very hard for us to understand where mercy lies in this writ of divorce, but perhaps you can see that in a society like that, it was Moses saying, protect the women. Poor peace, small protection. Society itself required the change. But now we're back to Joseph. This is why we say that Joseph acted in righteousness, and he took as much leeway, discretion, as he possibly could to act in mercy. That he would allow Mary her complete freedom, her reputation intact. Only two people would know what the circumstances were, and he would choose his witnesses, the suggestion is, to be private and quiet, that her reputation would not go forth destroyed. That's what was left to him, and that's what he would do. A righteous man. Now, as I apply that to where we are today, all I want to say is, bless you, Holden, for making a community, which is a community genuinely careful one of another, which really does create an inclusive sense of rules. Rules. I know you got rules. There's a Torah here like there is anywhere else, but that these are rules that other people participate in creating, honoring, and so forth and so on. Bless you. But you all know that this is a retreating place. You also know that sin enters in here too. We won't talk about that part. You know that when we go forth into the world, wherever we are, the choices that are left to Joseph are very much also like the choices that are left to us in the conditions of this world, because there are other forces and other laws that really do ring us round, and we may not love those laws, but because of the power of those laws, we end up having to obey them. So we strive, you and I, even in that world, that complex world, to be righteous. And I know of people who succeed, and bless them. I know of people who may be called, like Joseph, dikaios, dikaya, righteous, just, upright people. I've met them. I weep to meet them. But finally, what we have to say is, in this world and according to its likes, that's not enough. Good as Joseph is, blessed as he is, working within the parameters that are granted to him by his society, nevertheless, they will be separated. I mean, that's the sorrow of all this. Unless there's some intervention, this is the large word that applies to us all, unless there is some divine advent, some intervention for Joseph, they will be separated. And that's the opposite of God's desire. And that's the opposite of goodness for us. The opposite of separation is relation. And I say, we always experience life in relationship, and we always experience death as separation. The word that I put up here, which is translated dismiss or divorce, is for me a very important word. I may have touched upon it this summer. I don't remember if I did or not. It's the Greek word apolemi. And it comes with a grand association which teaches us why this is not enough and what still happens among us. Apolemi. Apolemi. It is the word that Jesus uses in the parables of Luke chapter 15, which we translate lost, right? So one of you has 100 sheep. A man has 100 sheep, and then a woman is going to have 10 coins. Each one loses one, and the word that's applied, the word that translates lost, is apolemi. It's the same word. Now just imagine for yourself what kind of separation that is for the sheep as well as for the shepherd or the woman who love those things. Imagine that. That's still what happens among us when we're righteous. This lostness means that one goes off without community. One goes off with all of its, the sheep's, stupidities and bumblingnesses, which can kill it alone. Or the coin loses all of its value. You understand that coin thing. If a coin is lost, it hath no value. I don't care what it is. A coin is always invested with the value of the owner and the other one who may take it. If you're a coin and you're lost, you might as well be dead meat or clay or... You understand what I'm saying? That's the loss of the coin. Its value is totally only in relationship. And you know what the parable is that follows. And then this really fulfills this word for us. It's the parable that we call the prodigal son and also the righteous brother. When that prodigal is gone and finally comes to himself and returns home and the father weeps with joy, he says two things now and makes the association very clear. This my son was lost, he says. This my son was, say it, dead. Dead and was found. Yeah, you were getting to the good part already. Thanks. You went to found. But that's, yeah, lost. Lost is the word apolemi, and dead is thanatos. It is the Greek word flat dead. Now let me add one more thought, and then I have to come back to this. But this word apolemi means the flat thing itself. That is, when the disciples are in the boat and the storm rises up and Jesus is sleeping in the back of the boat. You all remember that story? And one of the disciples, or all of them, get up and cry out, "Don't you care that we are perishing?" The word perishing is the same word. It's the exact same word. And here we're talking about physical dying and all that is attendant there too. And the fear and the panic you get when you see the waves of death about to crash over you. What I'm telling you then is, as righteous as we may be one to another, as hard as we work out our righteousness, it may not be enough. Righteousness can define roles, dear people, and it does a good job. Righteousness can withhold evil and shut it away. Righteousness can allow us as human beings to make a good go of it, living together and dividing the jobs and so forth and so on. But righteousness may not renew the broken relationship. What it does is it teaches us how to live on in spite of that broken relationship. You with me? Because when a divorce comes, when it actually happens, we suffer it like death. That's where I'm at. And for all the righteous, the dear people in my family that I know are righteous, I have in sometimes under their righteous separation, not because they're being grim. We're not talking about a harsh and powerful ecclesiology here. We're not talking about a church that's arrogating power to itself. We're talking about a boy who sinned. We're talking about people who really did sin and whose family recognized it and looked upon him and did the right, but this boy nevertheless felt separate. If they're only just him. And that separation felt to that boy, even though they hugged him and kissed him and all that stuff, it felt like death. In fact, you were with me that first day, hugging and kissing. You remember that story, and if you don't, I'll tell it to you afterward. Hugging and kissing itself burned like death, you know. It's not enough, which is why we gather. Because now comes the story of intervention. And it is here in Joseph's. Back to Matthew chapter 1, verse 18. And so in my part 3, I'm making such good time. Probably have to stop and tell a story. It's because I have a time, huh? Fill the time. And here it goes. And this is a paradigm for us. This is the paradigm of what happened. This is the first advent. What happens again and again, as I will show you. I wouldn't tell you all this hard stuff if there wasn't. Yes, I would. But a sweet closure. Well, here the story goes. But just when he had resolved to do this, just at that moment, that dangerous moment, by the way, if any of you like reading romances or love stories and so forth and so on, I'll give you the pattern and watch it happen. Two people fall in love, and they make plans for it all to work. Something intrudes and divides them. They almost get back together again. But just at that moment, something really bad intrudes and makes them even think one another is the problem. Do you see how that goes? So first they're together, then something worldly intrudes, but they can handle it, we can make it. And then as they're just back together again, this is also Othello. As you're almost back together again, you watch it. Then all of a sudden, something makes you distrust the love of the other, and that's the most horrible thing. Then all the audience says, no! No, she didn't do it, she really loves you. So that when they come together at the end, you know, it has that sweet singing, happy quality, they'll live happily ever after. Just when, that's why this story is so good, just when he was about to put her away, you know, he you don't blame him, but he's got the wrong notion. Just at that moment, when he's going to put her away. I don't think Matthew knew how close he was to romantic novels. An angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, an angel of the Lord, an angelos, a messenger comes. In a dream, again and again in Scripture, the sleeping individual is a quiet theological declaration. The sleeper doesn't do this. This is God. In the first part of Genesis, when God brings together two human beings, two created human beings, and one is Adam, the other is Eve, the whole idea of Adam's being sleeping at that point is simply a loud declaration. Adam doesn't do this. The gift of community, the gift of people with people, is a pure gift of God. God does that thing. And then we may join in naming one another in that delightful sense of name. But God, that's what sleep. So this is the nice thing. All of a sudden, the righteous man who's laboring at righteousness or thinks righteousness is all and finds out it's not enough, he quits. He doesn't do this. It's done for him. And the first stage over and over again, this embraces all of us, is the speaker comes. Somebody who bears the message. Somebody with the message comes. And in this case, that's the name. It's angel, messenger. Joseph, son of David. I like that part too, because so often that's the truth. I suddenly am very personally present. My name is called. Who I am, I can't back away from. I'm not merely an observer in this next exchange. It's me, y'all. And something in the exchange makes me tingle with personal presence. Something makes me know I'm here, though I'm the one sleeping and I'm not doing anything at all. So I'm not lurking at the edges and saying, well, I'm not. I mean, I tried to. That was my effort. I tried to lurk at the edges and say, well, what's going on in there? Let me see if... You know, this is Jesus' practice constantly. Somebody asked Jesus a question and... boom, he asked the question right back. Pontius Pilate says, so, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus doesn't say yes or no. Jesus says, do you say this of yourself? Quang, tingle, 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 self. Do you say this of yourself or did others tell it? Pontius Pilate doesn't like that notion. He says, am I a Jew? Don't ask me. So here I am tingling. Or Joseph, he's right there tingling. Joseph, son of David. This is going to be a gift I want to talk about in a little bit. I'll hold it for a while. Do not be afraid. It's a remarkable gift, people, and you've got to know how important that gift is for the Emmanuel. Do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. Remarkable. The angel says it and he stops doubting it. She will bear a son and you will name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. And then you have the prophecy. All this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Look, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. And in that section, we've got a lot. So here comes the messenger who picks up exactly what the facts are and remarkably reinterprets the scandal, the stumbling block, reinterprets the facts. and brings in a whole new view that a human being perhaps on his or her own would not be able to come to, because we only work with the stuff of this world, with our reason and with our strength. And it really does take a messenger. It takes me talking to you. It takes you talking to somebody else, not with golden and silver tongues, but just with the presence of faith within you. Just with that presence of faith, where individual acts and events in this world, which seem to be no more than horrid, begin to bear a glowing shine and the reality of forgiveness. Scandal is reinterpreted. It is the Holy Spirit who is accomplishing this thing, not Mary, not somebody else, no human being whatsoever. This is of the Holy Spirit. God is accomplishing this good thing. And what is this? Well, what God is accomplishing is intervention, is the coming of a child. And right here we have the two names of the infant, the one by which the human will be named, and the other one which declares what the effect of that presence is. So then this baby is going to be a thing, and this baby is going to do a thing. And the be a thing is Emmanuel. And that's the presence of God here among us, not far away so that you have to go to the tops of the mountains, but here on your tongue and near you, here in the nearest and most blessed of relationships that you affect with one another, there in that joining of hands, in that place is Emmanuel. I don't know if I should talk yet about the fear of that. Well, let me wait a little while. And what this child is going to do is Yeshua is, and it's interpreted here, save the people from their sins. Save them from all that even in righteousness ends up in separation and apolymy and the perishing that we cause for one another and also for ourselves. That's the act of what's going to happen when this child comes. It turns all back upon the stuff that made us suffer that not enough. Don't even have to do it. Don't even have to do it. That's the grace. You know, when I was 13 years old, 12, 13, 11, I took confirmation. Now I'm 54, so you got to track backward to understand what sort of confirmation classes we all had back in those days. Maybe you still do, I don't know. Well, 2 years of memorization. We had Schwann's catechism, which is Luther's small catechism expanded with proof texts and concepts, all of which we had to memorize. You know, that's what proof texts are. They're texts from the Bible which prove what we were said we believe. And they taught us grace, but we had to memorize it. And so although we got the words right, there was this basic quality. But if it's going to work, kid, you better memorize and get those words right. And suddenly the burden of grace is on us. Well, I went to confirmation class, and you all remember that my father was the president of Concordia College, and therefore I was upholding the Wangren name, not Wangren, the Wangren name. The oldest son, the first one to go through in public, the first one to declare publicly the conclusion of his baptism, which is that he is able to say that he believes in Jesus, me, that's me. I took it really seriously. Bethlehem Lutheran Church. There were 5 of us in that class. There were 2 girls who had come over from Holland, could scarcely speak English. They were just delighted. They loved the whole world. They didn't understand what we were talking about. And for some reason or other, because I had colics in those days, they pulled my hair. That's what I remember about those confirmation classes, these girls. One of them was really beautiful, pulling my hair, pulling it out even. They thought it was fun. They were bigger than I was. I was very small, 13. But I memorized. I really memorized. And there were 2 other boys in there, one of whom made everything a contest between us, and the other who really didn't care about anything, couldn't memorize. He lacked the capacity. But I worked really hard at it. It was important to get it right. I should tell you that in those days, my parents were going through their own struggles, not with each other, but with their context, where life was just horrible on my mother. It was a great burden on her. And it was the burden of gossip. And you can imagine, I mean, Dad, as the president, and perhaps not the president people had wanted in there and so forth. And I realized the importance of my getting things right for the Saturday before we were going to go into the confirmation examination. Did you have that? Mm-hmm. In front of the church? Yep.
Yep. We had a speech and stuff.
We were questioned.
So we had to get
we could be questioned on anything in the catechism. And I thought this was so serious. I knew it was serious because my mother bought me new underwear. She bought me new underwear and I had new clean clothes. And honestly, what I'm about to tell you is the truth. It's pitiful, but it's the truth. The night before, Saturday night, I took a bath, I washed my hair, and you know, I always had these horrible cowlicks. So I did a Dagwood. I took a nylon stocking and I pulled it over my head so that my hair would dry perfect. I wanted to be perfect on the next day. And so I put the stocking down and that's how I went to sleep. And I had the capacity in those days to sleep in exactly one position. I'm going to get it right. I slept in one position all night long and then came the morning and I'm going to put all my, I put on clean underwear. I was becoming clean. There was a sort of a baptismal quality in all this. I put on a new shirt and new pants, a little new suit, and I went into the bathroom and I took that nylon stocking off. And there shot up behind my head the most proud rooster tail of a collet that I'd ever seen before, nodding back there. I was horrified. I had done my best to be right. I had done my best to be perfect, you understand. And there was this, oh my Lord, I took water and drenched my hair. And I tried my best just to water it down. Nobody told me about real cream in those days. And little dabs and stuff. All I had was, and so I did the water. And I remember how my father drove me to church and I'm all dressed up like that. And I'm trying to hold so still because of the embarrassment of that colic, which the girls would pull anyway, and which made me look like some kind of dithering fool. Holding still. As we drove to church, and then I got out of the car first, and I'm thinking as I'm walking from the car to the church, is my dad proud of me? Is my mom proud of me? Am I doing all right? And I felt one hair go bing. I reached up and I grabbed that hair and pulled it out. Just look. Oh my heaven. And then we were in the church and we all walked in with these perfect little white gowns, you know, all five of us in a row. To the front of the church with all the people watching. My Aunt Erna came all the way from St. Louis up to Edmonton, Alberta, Canada with a new Bible, which I would get after I had answered the questions. Grace! Oh. Wally, get it right! There are all the people out there, and we get up in front, and we sit in a little semicircle of chairs, right? Facing the people! All of the good people! The pastor gets to turn around and look at us. His name is Wally Sheff. I remember that. Pastor Sheff. He turns and he asks questions. And of course, the Dutch girls can scarcely speak English, so what they're saying, everyone nods and smiles, but somebody better get it right up there. And this other fellow, who can't even hardly memorize anything, smiles, and he knows no guilt. God blessed him with innocence. And the fellow who's in contest is not asked first, I'm asked. I'm asked to give the meaning of the second article of the creed. You know, that Lutherian, what does this mean? So I get up and I feel on the back of my head, boing, 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 boing. I feel the collar start coming up all together. And I try to brush it down, tear it out, try to make myself presentable. I believe that Jesus Christ, true God, begotten of the Father from eternity and true man, born of the Virgin Mary, is my Lord. There it is, I'm saying it. There's the declaration of my faith, is my Lord. That he has redeemed me, a lost, what language, and condemned creature. Purchased and won me, not with gold and, no, purchased and won me from sin, from death, and from the power of the devil. Not with gold or silver. I'm saying this while it's going boing, 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 boing on the back. And now I have my hands up here. Not with gold or silver. And I hear that twerp, that shrewd contesting twerp beside me saying, not with gold or silver, but with this holy precious blood. So I shout even louder so they don't hear that he's kibitzing, but with his holy precious blood and his innocent suffering and death. I did it. I even said the right words to the second article of the creed, which are, I believe that I cannot by my own reason or strength believe in my Lord Jesus Christ or come to him, but the Holy Ghost has called me by the gospel. There's grace. I can't do it, but the Holy Ghost has done it. But do you want to see that little boy who walked out of church that day? I did it. They praised me. They patted me on the back. I got my Bible. Aunt Erna gave me a dry-lipped kiss on my cheek. We had a big meal. Everyone was pleased with Wally's performance. And now I felt I had entered adulthood, and from now on I had to do everything myself. That's how I felt. It was up to me. And I had six brothers and sisters younger than me, and my poor mother was going through torments of the gossip. My father was busy and gone all the time, and now I'm an adult, and it's up to me. And we entered a terrible winter after that. That fall, we lived in a huge house where the wind blew through it all the time, and I felt that somehow or other my behavior was responsible for the joy or the sorrow of the family. It's all on me. Now, I'm not asking for your pity. I do want you to see that there's some association between this righteousness and the whole concept of teaching grace and making little children have to memorize it and get it right. That they begin to feel the responsibilities of all the world. I didn't complain. I thought this is what adulthood was. I'm speaking to you from now, looking backward. But come November, about this time of the year, in Canada, it's colder than it is here, I got really, really sick. And it came on me all at once, and I remember about the second or third night, I was in my bed, which is upstairs. It's in the way upstairs. It's in the attic. And I didn't even know I was groaning. But there's no reason to call anyone else because you understand it's all on me. I'm doing right. I'm doing the best that I can. I don't even know that I'm groaning, and the light goes on outside of my bedroom door, and I see the frame of light there, which is almost blurry to me because I hadn't anticipated it. And that's the point, dear people. I did not anticipate it. I truly did not anticipate it. The light went on and the door opened up, and there in the doorway was an angel. The purest angel that ever did come to a child or to Joseph. The angel almost floated diaphanous into my room. The light was behind her, you know, and so I could almost see the form of her body within the nightgown as she floated in. And it was my mother. I didn't expect her. I didn't even know that she had heard me groan. But she floated in and she sat on the edge of my bed, and the weight of her sitting bent the mattress down so that I, the child, just by the shape of I rolled up against my mother's body. What a gift. Not a word at all, first of all, but this remarkable thing, no, you don't do it alone. No, you don't have to do it alone. I'm here. And against my mother's body, I could smell her smells, which I remembered from childhood, and for a moment I was granted to be a child again. And there was nothing wrong with that. She'd come to heal me. I was granted to be a child again. No. Yes. And then she reinterpreted everything. She did two things and reinterpreted the whole world for me. She took her hand, her cool hand, and she put it upon my fevered forehead. And I felt in that moment holiness and sacredness. The pure gift that asks nothing in return. And there's no need for anyone, for this particular person, to have been right or good to receive it. And the second thing was a marvelous gospel. She said, Wally, if you pull your knees up to your chest, it'll help your tummy feel better. Mm-hmm. I pulled my knees up to my chest, and behold, my tummy felt better. And it may have been that that's exactly what I needed in terms of medicine. It's absolutely what I needed in terms of grace. That's the point of my story. When we have lived like Joseph and we have done our best, not our damnedest, because we are seeking goodness, we've done our best in every way to obey and to act in mercy. And when nevertheless things become so heavy that we find ourselves in separation, this is the promise of Christmas. This is why Christmas recurs over and over again in our celebrations, but this is the promise. And it doesn't have to be with bright, shiny things. It may be the most common individual of all, that one will come and one will call you by name. And you will tingle with the presence of this event. And if you understand the angelic quality of that person, then you'll understand that it's all of gospel and God that's occurring at that moment. And it may be when you receive communion. It often happens at Holy Communion, or it happens when we lay a cross here, a cross laid down among us, not up, but down among us, and we can reach forward, we can touch it, and we can break into tears. Not just because we are praying so well, and because the symbol of the presence of Jesus is here, but because these people are singing around us, you know, as angels. Do they know it? No. If they began to know it, they might become a tad proud. Did my mother know what she had done? No, she was just doing the lovely thing. You follow? And all of that is the word that comes, which then grows into fuller and more complex stuff. This is the news. This is the good news. God is among us. And God in Jesus Christ has done away with these sins that we have been struggling with so much ourselves. These sins, which are the core and the beginning of separations and dyings among us, has done away with them so that in that name we may be drawn back together one unto another, no longer striving for righteousness, but being righteous nonetheless. The whole new kind of righteousness. Completely new kind of righteousness. Do you understand? That's what Christmas is. I have to tell you, and then these are the things that come of that righteousness. Oh, the gracious witness, remember the promise. That's what Isaiah is doing in Matthew's text. It goes back to the 7th chapter of Isaiah. Now I hope you all remember the stuff we've talked about here. It's Isaiah talking to King Ahaz. Remember him? Mm-hmm. Do you remember how violent Ahaz was with his children, passing them through the fire to Moloch, to death? Unto that king, Isaiah said, ask God for a sign. Ask God for a sign. Let it be as high as heaven or as low as the earth. Ask God for a sign that holiness is around you and that you shall be protected. And Ahaz's answer, not seeing the angel, is, oh, it is not for me to weary or to presume upon God. That's what Ahaz said. Listen to me. It is not for me to weary God's ear or to presume upon God. And Isaiah answered, well, God gives you a sign anyway. For a young maiden, or if you will, because that's how we take it in the New Testament, a virgin will conceive a son and bear a son. And that child's name shall be Emmanuel. Now you know the context behind this thing. And if it's said as a gracious witness back then to Ahaz, what do you think it means unto us? Oh, are you going to tell me that my life has destroyed signs? I'll probably agree with you, but you see, God gives the sign anyway. You can't shut that down. You and your Lutheran Nordic humility, oh no, I don't mean to bother God. I'll just do my work. Anyway, I have to tell you then, these are the things that are granted unto us as gifts of this new righteousness, which has a source in Jesus and not in ourselves. The first is that we do not fear. I've got to pause on that. Can you imagine what Ahaz would have felt like if the thing itself, the God, appeared? I don't know, but you've got to spend a little time thinking that Emmanuel alone is a terrible thing. That the Creator appearing unto the created is not immediately a lovely thing, and we have goose pimples of being petted and stroked. For me, when I was in graduate school, one of the horrors that I was, when I left my faith, I was gone. And the one thing that I knew for sure is that there was a God. And as time passed in graduate school, I came to hate that God. And the reason that I hated God was that God was infinitely self-sufficient. God was the single thing in or beyond the cosmos that needed nothing else. God, I said to myself, and I think I was right, God could imagine and it was. God could desire and it existed. And because God existed like that, my being was diminished to putrid dust because I could imagine as good as God, but I couldn't do it. So God's infinitude against me was just a persistent burning with my finitude. God's limitlessness, according to me, even before there's a Jesus, just this creating quality of God is frightening to me because it cannot but diminish me to my limited span of years. And that's what it did to me in graduate school. I did not like that God. So you tell me Emmanuel and you don't say Yeshua, you're just going to scare me. You tell me here comes the creating God into the world and God is going to be very present and you're going to stand before this one and I'm going to start thinking of galaxies upon galaxies and metagalaxies. God sneezed and there was a universe? I used to think of God as this infinite, this is my image, this infinite figure sleeping in bed, sleeping in complete fat self-sufficiency, needing nothing and needing no one, would just turn over in bed and drop an arm and hit me. Beep. Wouldn't even notice that I died because of that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Emmanuel? Nevertheless, the angel says, and this is the first gift of this righteousness, that we have this boldness, as Luther says. And unless you understand the grandeur and the greatness of God, you don't understand the boldness that Luther talks about. We have this boldness to go face on God and talk boldly unto God without fear and say, now here are my prayers. What are you going to do about it? If all we had was that other guy, then we'd understand this that the black community understands so well. Mountains and hills fall on me at the heavy wrath of God. So then this becomes such a sweet gift of Christmas that we do not fear before Emmanuel. That we are in that relationship to Emmanuel. And here, dear people, I can hardly contain the beauty of this thing. With the righteousness which doesn't have its source in me, but has its source in godness. The goodness that has its source in godness, which is given unto me as a gift. Hey, I can be so good. I can be so good. I'm none of this stuff anymore. I mean, I slipped into. Oh, how good we can be. We really can obey. We really can translate that sweet mind of God into action, physical manifest action here in this world. We can. That doesn't mean that we're always perfect and always good, but it does mean that we are in this progress. This is a very Lutheran doctrine of sanctification. We are growing holier and holier every day. Rejoice in that. We are growing holier and holier every day, and somewhere as we're growing holier, there's this thin line beyond which we're going to suddenly hit perfection. And it's all of a piece. We're growing holier and holier every day, and then we'll cross that thin line, which from this side looks like a wall, but from that side looked like birth. And we will be perfect. So this, hear me, so this present developing goodness in us participates in the perfection to come. What is this line called? It's called death. Immediately on the other side of all that would trammel us here in this world, all these rules that we follow in our efforts to be righteous, immediately on the other side, that which we are reaching to, it's not like something else, it's like the fulfillment of this that we're working out together, one with another, and the source is God. We will be perfect. That's the righteousness. It continues to get better and be made new. And then the very last, where am I getting all this from? Well, Joseph rises up and obeys. Verse 24, when Joseph awoke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded him. He took her as his wife. Okay. That's why I said, I think Joseph is probably like my father-in-law. Had an angel, had a vision, got knocked over, no one noticed. He got up and did what he was supposed to do. Because he could.
Do this thing.
Well, the one who asks us empowers us. Got up and did it. That's the goodness. But had no marital relations with her until she had borne a son. And then here is the last five words in this translation. And he named him Jesus. Oh, I should have a whole nother hour. I don't, so don't worry. Do you understand what a gift it is given unto us to name Jesus? I mean, think of Joseph. Joseph and Mary together gathered around this infant and they said, what shall we name him? Oh, we'll name this one God. They got the name elsewhere, you understand, but they're the ones who in public conferred the name. And other people knocked on the door and they said, ah, little baby, coochie-coo, what's the baby's name? God. Oh, no. It wasn't that obvious. Yeshua, which was a common name. I know that. But the way in which it's told here, the name defined the event to come. For he shall save his people from their sins. And that's what's granted us. Sacrament tomorrow. Maya, are you going to be the
designer?
She's going to name Jesus. It's a gift. She's going to put her hands over the elements and name Jesus here, just like Joseph did. In this place, Jesus. In this place, body. In this place, blood, Jesus. What a gift. What a holy gift. It's beyond us. It's beyond our abilities. Nevertheless, it's a gift given unto us. And you know, the three of us gathered together the other night and we talked. And Jesus was there. Because we named the presence of Jesus there. What a gift of naming. In the beginning, God did not reveal a name. God was called Elohim, or God was called with that generic God's term. When Moses got all nervous about going into Egypt and said, what name shall I give them? God said, all right, I'm going to give you a name. It's going to be ironic, but this name will allow you to do the most miraculous thing on earth. If you call it, I'll come. That's what names are, people. When one gives you the gift of his or her secret name, when you receive that one secret name, which is more than just the handle, which is the wholeness of self, that's the covenant that doesn't break. When you call it, they come. So Moses can say whatever, Yahweh, and God was there. What a gift. Nevertheless, it's ironic because this is still this Emmanuel, because the name means I will be what I will be. Go ahead, call me. But I nevertheless maintain the sufficiency. I just put it before you as a gift of God. And then comes Jesus, and the name is not ironic anymore. It isn't an irony anymore, I will be what I will be. It's when you say the name, you declare the purpose. And so I did, you know, so we point, we declare. I name in my story the presence of my mother as the presence of Jesus coming. We can do that. And when we speak the name, when we speak the name, and this is the whole business of the New Testament, you know, preaching in the name of Jesus has power. Against evil, for love, for the gathering of people, when you speak the name, it's as if Joseph and Mary were speaking it first. Jesus is here. This is an invocational name. You say it and it is true. Jesus is here. You can go away and call my name and you might get a bit of me, might get a piece of my reputation. Not all of me, but you say Jesus and all of Jesus is there. That's Christmas. That's what this story is about, this intervention in human affairs. I'm so grateful you listened to me just tell this one.